This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees.
It's Wednesday, the 13th of February, and this is your BizNews briefing. In our top story, South Africa's Foreign Minister Ronald Lamola has vowed to push ahead with South Africa's genocide case against South Africa at the International Court of Justice. This despite an executive order signed by Donald Trump punishing South Africa for its aggressive stance towards Israel. Earlier, I caught up with the Financial Times' David Pilling.
Yes, well, our story, we interviewed three key people in the administration, Ronald Lamola, John Steenhuisen, and Songeza Zibi, who were all reacting to America's very public sort of humiliation, let's say, or aggressive attitude towards South Africa, telling it that it was going to withdraw aid, hinting that it was going to remove South Africa from AGOA. Quite aggressive acts that seem to have come, in a sense, for South Africa at least, out of the blue. There was no normal diplomatic back-channeling or hint that this was about to come. This has happened in, you know, in tweets or whatever we call tweets these days. Truth Social, I think, in the case of Donald Trump. This comes, of course, in the context that South Africa is not the first and presumably will not be the last to feel Donald Trump's wrath. And there's the added spice, I guess, that Elon Musk was born or at least lived in South Africa for many years and is South African and clearly is very important in the Trump administration. But remember, Trump had gone for Canada, he'd gone for Denmark over Greenland, he'd gone for Panama. He has a plan to turn Gaza into a Riviera. So you could just see this. I mean, not just, but you could see this as the latest, and presumably there will be others. Of course, this puts South Africa in a terribly difficult position. Some of it, one could argue, of its own making, and some of it not at all. There seem to be several beefs with South Africa. I don't think we should look necessarily for coherence from the U.S. administration, but the beefs are land expropriation. I think crucially, South Africa's action in 2023 in taking Israel to the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, I think the ICJ. There's also talk in the executive order about alleged links between South Africa and Iran. And it is true that Naledi Pandor went to Iran, I think, pre the last election. But, you know, that doesn't really amount to, you know, the kind of accusations that the US is making about this. So I think there are many elements to this story, really. You know, what does a country do when it comes under the fire of Donald Trump? I mean, some countries have chosen to give in. Colombia kind of gave in and was let off. You know, Canada and Mexico, you know, kind of made some polite noises about trying to address some of Trump's concerns, and the tariffs went away. What should South Africa do? I mean, that's absolutely not for me to say. I think we got a hint of it in our story, where South Africa said it's not going to climb down from this case at the ICJ. I don't think it can climb down anyway, because the case is made and is now pending a judgment. But in any case, I think that's a statement that we will not be bullied, which were the words I was coming on to, which I think were the crucial words, really, in the 90-minute speech that Cyril Ramaphosa gave last week. And that, I think, will be South Africa's position. It will, of course, also scramble, as it really should in the national interest, to try and repair the damage if it can. You know, it will send emissaries to Washington. They'll talk. They'll say, no, Mr. President, you misunderstand the expropriation bill. You know, Mr. President, you know, we have a principled and long established policy on Palestine going back to Nelson Mandela, et cetera, et cetera. You know, whether the Trump administration will listen or not, I can't possibly tell you. But I think South Africa, as a, you know, relatively small in the grand scheme of things country, a long way away from Washington, there's only kind of so much influence it will have. It's it's now there's a new world, really, where you have, you know, we used to have different powers that you might say were rising or trying to challenge the post-war established order. China, by growing fast and not turning democratic, by remaining a kind of authoritarian power. Russia, by being very authoritarian and also being very aggressive, particularly clearly in Ukraine. You know, you could call them rogue states. I think you could call the US a rogue state now. I mean, it's not playing by any rules that we're used to. And this puts a country like South Africa, that's trying to kind of be friends to everyone, get along with everybody, in quite a difficult position. As I say, it will not be the only one, but it's but that is the dilemma that it's now faced with.
I spoke to Iraj Abidian, who is the founder of Pan African Capital, and he says the problem with South Africa's stance in this case is twofold. One, a lack of consistency in terms of how South Africa has dealt with human rights violations elsewhere globally, and two, that South Africa's allegiance with Iran may not necessarily be in the best national interests for South Africa.
The peace laureate in Iran, Narges Mohammadi, has been in prison, is in prison, dying in prison. She is the equivalent of our Bishop Tutu in terms of her support of human rights, equality, and specifically women rights. And yet, to the best of my knowledge, the South African government has not issued a statement to say this is not acceptable behavior on the part of a member of the human community. And for Iran to argue that this is the law of our land, we're doing our own way culturally and so on, is exactly like Netanyahu says, this is my country, this is the protection of our interests. Exactly the same, except that Netanyahu is unfortunately exacting those atrocities against 2 million people, the regime in Iran exacting, you know, 90 million, and specifically 45, 50 million of them women. Now, it is this inconsistency that South Africa has to deal with and puts us, Branwen, on the back foot. We, in the court of international opinion, in the court of checking the facts, it puts us on the back foot and it's put at serious risk our national economic interest. So, yeah, I can sympathize, not empathize, sympathize with Minister Lamola saying we have to continue because we've started, and I'm not a lawyer, I do not know the procedures, but clearly South Africa has gone wrong with that case, but that is no excuse not to protect the national interest. That's where my view is.
Let's talk about that national interest and where to from here. Because by all accounts, it could be calamitous for South Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. Because at the moment, if I read correctly, our government is taking a very old style, not necessarily incorrect, but old style political posture, which goes along the following line. We are for multilateralism. We are principled, we are following our values. Well, that position put within a context that the big powers globally, Russia does not believe in multilateralism, believes that it has to do what it has to do in Ukraine, and blames NATO. NATO says we have to do what we have to do. And of course, most recently, President Trump comes and says, all these multilateral frameworks are against the United States, so I'm going to throw them out of the window or put a big, big break on it for now. Now, the big China is the same, UK and EU the same. So the big players, the big participants of multilateralism have, by all practical purposes, left the paradigm. They are doing their own things. Italy is doing its own thing. Germany is doing its own thing, etc., etc., etc. And yet, South Africa is not playing the old game, which puts the national interests at risk. I must emphasize, Bronwyn, that as an economist, we all agree and we can prove it that multilateralism is the best for human community. But multilateral institutions and the practice of multilateralism on a selective basis by all players, United States, Russia, China, and now suddenly South Africa. Selectively, you want to be multilateral, you compromise your national interest. We need to rethink, we need to literally put a alt, delete, control, and reboot, and go to a different paradigm that protects jobs, protects our growth, and protects the welfare of the nation.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
You can catch that full interview with Iraj Bidian, the founder of Pan African Capital, on biznews.tv. Yesterday, Alex spoke to Kali Creel, the CEO of AfriForum. And Creel says that the issues that they are highlighting as AfriForum around the Expropriation Act are not just a storm in a teacup. He specifically points to Section 19.2 of the Act. Let's take a listen.
The problems are real. And now they're saying, no, this Expropriation Act is not that bad. And fortunately, you also have business people, also other parties within the GNU that are saying, no, it's not really this bad. But the problem is, if we could avert the crisis by just saying it's not this bad, then it's fine if you have that attitude. But do they really think the Americans are stupid? That the Americans will say, these people are saying it's not that bad, so it's not that bad. They read that. And they read Section 19.2 of the Expropriation Act. What that says is, of course, if there's not an agreement with regard to the price of a property, and the government decides, expropriation authority, and by the way, that can be any radical municipality, can now start doing this, they can then expropriate without an amount being agreed to. Then they say, now you can go to court. Well, let's look at the practicality. Within 180 days, you can go to court, but remember, you've already lost your property. And the government can take possession already, so you don't have that, so you can't make an income from that. Now you'll have to go to court. But because this would be an action and not a motion, the difference between the two is action, there will have to be evidence led by experts because there's going to be a dispute on the amount. If you're going to start an action process today in this country, we want to go to the High Court. The first date you can get is in 2028, 3 years from now. So such a court case will take longer than 5 years. Now you can imagine, you're going to lose your land. You have to fight at your own cost in court to maybe then get your money in 5 years' time. What would the net effect of that be? People would say, well, they've offered me now half of the amount, but at least I'm getting something because I don't have the government uses taxpayers' money. I don't have the funds to fight this. And in the end, property rights would be infringed. So why people say this is false propaganda, one can just ask him, go and read 19.2 and then explain to me why this is not a problem.
Yesterday, an Elon Musk group made an almost $100 billion bid for OpenAI. Our colleagues at Bloomberg sat down with the CEO of OpenAI, Sam Altman, who doesn't hold back on his feelings about Musk.
Sam, of course, the headlines right now, Elon Musk making a bid
apparently
for OpenAI. Your response, you're turning him down for $97 billion.
I mean, look, OpenAI is not for sale. The OpenAI mission is not for sale. Elon tries all sorts of things for a long time. This is the late, you know, this week's episode.
You take it seriously at all? What do you think he's trying to drive at with this?
I think he's probably just trying to slow us down. He obviously is a competitor. It's, you know, he's working hard and he's raised a lot of money for XAI, and they're trying to compete with us from a technological perspective, from, the, you know, getting the product into the market. And I wish he would just compete by building a better product, but I think there's been a lot of tactics, you know, many, many lawsuits, all sorts of other crazy stuff, now this. And we'll try to just put our head down and keep working.
Does it make it more difficult to move from that non-profit model to that for-profit model for OpenAI?
We're not moving to a for-profit model. We're not sure we're going to do it all, but no matter what, the nonprofit will continue to be extremely important. It will drive the mission. It will continue to exist. The board is looking at lots of options about how to best structure for this next phase, but the nonprofit is not changing into anything or going anywhere.
Okay. What is your main mission here at the Paris AI Action Summit? You got Stargate. There's question marks about how much you're actually going to commit to that. Maybe you can give us some numbers on that, Sam. What is the messaging here from you and the team?
So I've been to an earlier version of this at Bletchley Park, and that one was more focused on safety. This one, people are still talking about safety, but really I think people are now saying, okay, this technology is here. It's having incredible impact. We've got to drive it. There is a lot of questions about how people can, you know, maybe the most common question I've gotten is, can you do a Stargate in my country? You know, we need infrastructure here. We want to do this. Can you help? So that's been a common one. But a lot of other things about just how are we going to deploy this technology to make sure people benefit? Where's it going to go? You know, in what ways is the model going to improve? Last week, we launched this thing called Deep Research. There's been a ton of questions about that. You know, how can we use this to really drive economic growth? But yeah, maybe economic growth has been the single biggest theme here.
And have you had clarity on DeepSeek? I know you and the team have been looking into that, whether they distilled, whether they inappropriately used your inferencing data. Have you had more clarity on that?
I mean, whether
that?
They what, did or didn't, they,
a challenge,
they
a threat?
Built a good model. Many people will distill from many other models. Again, I feel so confident about our research roadmap and also our product roadmap that, you know, DeepSeek will do whatever DeepSeek is going to do. Other people do whatever they're going to do. And we're just going to try to, like, build the best technology we can and get it into people's hands. And I think that's mostly going pretty well.
Do you think Musk's approach, then, is from a position of insecurity about XAI?
Probably his whole life is from a position of insecurity. I feel for the guy.
You feel for him?
I do, actually. I don't think he's, like, a happy person. I do feel for him.
Okay. Do you worry that he has this proximity to the president and that he can influence the decision-making of the U.S. presidency and policies around this agenda on AI?
Not particularly. Maybe I should, but not particularly. I mean, I try to just wake up and think about, like, how we're going to make our technology better.
Our colleagues in Bloomberg bring us this story from Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Chair, who is tempering expectations around future interest rate cuts out of the U.S. Let's take a listen.
With our policy stance now significantly less restrictive than it had been, and the economy remaining strong, we do not need to be in a hurry to adjust our policy stance. We know that reducing policy restraint too fast or too much could hinder progress on inflation. At the same time, reducing policy restraint too slowly or too little could unduly weaken economic activity and employment. In considering the extent and timing of additional adjustments to the target range for the federal funds rate, the FOMC will assess incoming data, the evolving outlook, and the balance of risks. As the economy evolves, we will adjust our policy stance in a manner that best promotes our maximum employment and price stability goals. If the economy remains strong and inflation does not continue to move sustainably toward 2%, we can maintain policy restraint for longer. If the labor market were to weaken unexpectedly or inflation were to fall more quickly than anticipated, we can ease policy accordingly. We are attentive to the risks on both sides of our dual mandate, and policy is well positioned to deal with the risks and uncertainties that we face.
In Africa news, Bloomberg brings us this update on Rwanda amid the M23 rebels in the Congo.
Rwanda could face an economic backlash over its support for the M23 rebels who have seized territory in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The IMF and S&P Global Ratings have warned the African nation about the financial cost of the crisis, while major donors like the UK have threatened to freeze aid. For more on this, let's bring in Bloomberg's Andiro Oganga, who is joining us now from Kigali. So, Andiro, what kind of impact has the fighting in the eastern part of the DRC had on Rwanda? Based on some of the stats that we have.
Hi, Jen. So we are seeing Rwanda's president, who was a darling of the West at some point, become growing isolated. And this is raising the risk of Rwanda feeling some sort of financial pain. If you look at their Eurobond that is maturing in 2021, $620 million, it fell by 2.2% to trade at 81.9 cents to the dollar when M23 entered Goma. Though they've recouped some of those losses and is currently trading at 83.4 cents to the dollar. If we zoom in on the Rwandan economy, the budget deficit 6.9%. Debt to GDP grew to 80% in 2024. And this was before the fighting and also the threats to cut aid. And they were assigned moderate risk of external debt distress. I say this because Rwanda is an economy that is heavily dependent on aid and also external financing. And so should that plug be pulled because of this fighting that's happening in DRC, then the economy could be in trouble. And IMF sums it up really well, saying that the prolonged crisis could lead to significant humanitarian but also economic losses, adding that the country is going to feel fiscal pressure and there could also be delays in development financing.
Well, and as you mentioned, that's key for Rwanda, right? So, Andiro, if we don't see the fighting stop and if we actually see international pressure financially continue to mount, what does that then look like?
What it looks like is a country that will experience slowed economic growth. Grants account for 5% of total spending. If you look at external project financing, 22%. And if this is not there, then it means that we will see a slowdown in infrastructure spending, which is a big driver of this economy. We could see a slowdown in tourism receipts. And also, Rwanda will lose access or could lose access to the concessional loans. And what this means is that they will have to resort to commercial borrowing. This will increase their debt servicing costs. It could risk depreciation of their currency, which comes at a time where a bulk of their debt is in foreign currency. Also, gold accounts for a large portion of their revenue. IMF estimates that by 2026, it will be $2.3 billion. DRC is calling for a ban of sale of minerals from Rwanda. So all this compounded could affect that economy. And observers are saying that also Rwanda is a country that is very susceptible to international pressure. In 2012, when aid was cut, we saw that economy shrink from 8.6% to 4.8%. So they have everything to lose in their projected medium and future terms.
That's it for today's BizNews briefing. We'll be back tomorrow bringing you more context on the local and global front. Thanks as always for watching.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.